Hi friends, and welcome back to yet another episode of What Page Are You On? It me, Bethany Rutter, and I'm here with my good friend and business partner.
It me, Alice Slater.
We are also joined by...
Coco Mellors.
Yes, we are. We are joined by Coco Mellors, author of Cleopatra and Frankenstein, which is a book that we talked very briefly about in the last episode, because that was what I was reading when we were recording the last episode. And we're so blessed to have Coco on the pod today to chat to us about the book. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, so happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
And you have some delightful background
absolutely.
Noise. Oh, sorry. I was just going to comment on the hummingbird sounds and the like. Tell us about them.
Yes. There are birds, there's cheeping. There is also always a leaf blower, which is the great obsession of the sort of general American, is blowing their leaves around. I'm not sure what the purpose is. They don't suck the leaves up. They just blow them to other people's property, I think. So there will be a leaf blower somewhere. And there's also a very large and fearless squirrel close to me right now.
Where are you?
I am sitting in the garden in LA of a... I live in Venice in LA on the west side by the beach, but I'm house sitting for a friend who has a swimming pool. So I'm sitting by their pool. It's very like California dreams.
Oh my god, so this is nice. This is like LA swimming pool ASMR.
Yes.
It really is. I was just saying to my husband actually that I do think that all my life's problems can be solved by a pool. I was like, I don't know why I thought I had any issues. I'm completely fine as long as I'm by a swimming pool.
Oh, that's so charming. I could just see you relaxing in the pool. Just, you know, life is good. It's sunny. There's someone blowing their leaves, adding to the ambiance.
I just don't believe that anybody in LA has enough leaves on the 30th of March that they need to blow.
Yeah, I was like, where are these leaves coming from?
I honestly could not tell you. When I first experienced a leaf blower, I think when I first moved to America, I was like, but what's the point? Like, why not just let the leaves be?
We do not come from a leaf blowing culture, is what we
do not come from a leaf blowing culture.
We would love for you to nutshell Cleopatra and Frankenstein, because we could do it, but I'd always prefer to hear it from the brain of the author themselves.
Yes, I'm very happy to. I also love the use of nutshell as a verb.
To nutshell.
I shall commence to nutshell. So Cleopatra and Frankenstein is the story of the shockwaves caused by a very impulsive marriage between a couple, Cleo and Frank, who meet on New Eve in New York in 2007 and have this sort of instant, electrifying, undeniable chemistry. He is 20 years older than her, she's in her 20s and he's in his 40s, and 6 months later they get married, partly for her green card because she wants to stay in America, she's British, and mostly because they're in love. And then the story is told from their perspectives and the perspectives of a group of their friends and family in New York, all at the sort of intersection of art, fashion, advertising, film, who are affected by this relationship. And I always say it's kind of like the feeling of the book is very, it's the night out and it's the morning after. It's the sort of fantasy of life in New York. And then it's also very much the kind of fall and decay of that fantasy.
That is such a good nutshelling.
That was a well-practiced nutshell. That was perfect.
Yes, it's not my first nutshell, let me tell you.
Okay, so to kick us off, I'm going to ask the first question, if I may. In my research, just learning as much as I can about Cleopatra and Frankenstein, I came across an anecdote that the inspo for the book came from a story from your parents' honeymoon.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
So my mother had told me this story, like quite casually, actually, that on her honeymoon to my father, he had gotten drunk, he now no longer drinks, and was balancing on the balcony and was betting with the other hotel guests whether he could dive from the balcony into the swimming pool below through this blow-up toy. And my mother was like furious with him because instead of sort of like paying attention to her and having the honeymoon be about them, he was just showing off. So she was sort of smoking a cigarette behind him and she said, you know, I hope you jump and I die.
Jesus
and this was told this like... still, my parents are still married 40 years later. So this is told as a kind of funny anecdote in my family. And when I was in my MFA, we were asked to do an exercise where we wrote a scene in which the emotional kind of topography is in direct conflict to what you would expect given the situation. So, you know, an example of that would be a funeral in which the narrator finds everything very funny, or a wedding in which everything is very sad. So I decided to write a honeymoon scene, but instead of what you would expect, which is like romance, harmony, you know, love, tenderness, what you actually get is discord and strife and disappointment. And I didn't want to write about my parents at all. I was not interested in trying to diagnose their marriage. So I just made up fictional characters who could have ended up on this kind of very unusual honeymoon. And that was the beginning of Cleo and Frank.
Amazing. That's so interesting. And can I just ask, was that under Amy Hempel?
Yes, that was my teacher, Amy Hempel, yeah. Who's like the best teacher. I have many really good teachers, but she's my favorite teacher ever.
I'm in awe. I just love her work so much.
Her work is incredible, and her whole like way of being in the world is really just, it's incredibly graceful. Like, she's just a very, I don't know, she's incredibly generous. She's a really, really kind and open-hearted teacher. She really gave me the confidence to write. I love it. Love you, Amy.
Shout out to Amy. A book that we collectively, me and Alice, love is A Visit from the Goon Squad by Jennifer Egan. And this kind of reminded both of us of that book, in that it feels kind of like interconnected short stories that is also a very coherent novel. Did you always envisage it as a novel?
I did, yeah. One, first of all, that is a ginormous compliment. I love Jennifer Egan. I think she's just one of the most, I think she's a fantastic writer on a sentence level. And then specifically with that novel, she does structurally is incredible. I always imagined it as a novel, but I truly had no idea how to write a book. It's not that easy to write long form work. I remember thinking like, but I don't know how to make it all work together. So I was much more confident in scene than I was thinking big picture about plot. So I would just write scenes, you know, I would write this scene and then another scene, and then they would form chapters, and then I would try to get the chapters to make sense together. And I know there are other people who definitely think, I think because when you're writing from multiple perspectives, you have to stay very focused in the chapter you're in. Mm-hmm. And it's a very different experience writing each chapter as opposed to if you write a whole book in first person. So that book was a big influence on me. And so I'm very happy to see that, to hear that you could see that.
Because I think it was like, it was kind of the texture as well. It was the way that, so the book is set over, is it like a 2-year period?
Yes.
Something like that. So yeah, 2-year period. And yeah, it's definitely, I think, the way that information about other characters is delivered very elegantly, often through dialogue or through, almost in passing. So like, for example, the thing that sticks out is whether or not Cleo goes to Rome. I hope that's not a spoiler. Mm-hmm. But the way that that is planted as a seed in one chapter, and then in another chapter you find out whether or not she went. Do you know what I mean? It's like that kind of texture really reminded me of like the scope of A Visit from the Goon Squad.
That's so cool. And, you know, I did think about that a lot. Like, you know, we are pack animals as humans. Like, we do kind of function, the family is a group often, you know? And so when I was thinking about a marriage, I was not only thinking about it as like a two-hander, which is just two people. Like, marriages and relationships, like, they're deeply affected by and they affect the people around them. And it's so true of my own life that, like, so much of how I kind of gather information is in passing about others, and then that. And then that can like change what's happening in the trajectory of my own life and experience.
Yeah, no, that makes total sense. So then thinking about that relationship that's at the core of the book, like age gap discourse is a real thing that can whip the internet up into a frenzy. Were you like intentionally thinking about breaking taboos in writing an age gap like Cleo and Frank's?
No, I mean, honestly, it's like, when I started this book, I was 25 and I didn't even really, I mean, I always wanted to write a novel, but I didn't know that this would be my novel because it started as just a scene that I wrote. So when I picked Cleo and Frank as characters, I mean, I did so with a kind of like lightness of like, oh, this is just what I'm going to write about today. I wasn't like, and here they're going to be with me for the next 7 years of my life.
7 years?
Yes. I mean, I started it when I was 25 and I'm now 32. So,
Oh, wow.
So, I mean, thank God I didn't know that because I would have really labored over who they were so much more. Whereas I made Cleo younger and Frank older because it was something. One, it was just, I saw it a lot in my sort of community in New York. Like, I just saw that there were often these large age gaps and the women were usually younger. So in that sense, it came from just observation. And it felt true. It felt true to the world that I was writing about. Only later did I see that I was exploring. For me, like, I never write something in order to explore a theme. I write something because it feels emotionally true. And I just, and it's, you know, it sparks something inside of me. And then afterwards, I can see, I'm like, oh, that's something that I was exploring unconsciously. You know, and I think the sort of currency of desirability, the kind of capital of power, which is given to women very briefly for their youth or their beauty in their 20s, which often turns out to be a very illusory form of power that, like, when interrogated or lived in for longer than a few moments, kind of crumbles around you, is something I was interested in looking at, and how it would feel for Cleo, the kind of seduction, not only of, you know, meeting someone you're attracted to, but in feeling so desired in that moment. But what does that look like when it has to hold up against the real sort of stresses and strains of life and a relationship? And does it actually end up feeling like power at all?
Yeah, like the reality.
It is so interesting. I feel like it did explore that extremely effectively. That kind of, is it power? And if it is, where does it actually get me? Like, what is the actual upside of you know, having this like privilege or power or whatever it is? So there is partway through the book, a turn in the narration style. And obviously throughout the book, we do get kind of to see what other characters are up to. But there is like a shift to another first person point of view in the book. Why did you choose to give it to that particular character?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, it's interesting, this whole book, like a very traditional, I think, way to have written this novel would have been to only write from the perspective of the young female character, because she's the one who, you know, seemingly on the surface is the most aligned with me as an author. And that was never, ever interesting to me. So, you know, we hear from Cleo, we also, half the book is dedicated to male characters. And we get Frank's perspective and we get his friend's perspectives. So, and for me, just as a writer, like, that's what makes my life interesting, is having to inhabit other minds and sort of experiences and mentalities. I knew, I started to write, partly because I had just been working on this novel for such a long time. I was experimenting doing other things, you know, so I wanted to try writing in first person, and I really was interested in this first person fragment form that, you know, Mary Robeson does it to amazing effect, and Maggie Nelson. So there are a bunch of writers who do this really wonderfully. And one of the things I was interested in is whether or not I could use it to create kind of punchline humor. So I really wanted to try to write funny, and it's quite scary to try to be funny on the page. It's actually like much easier to try to make someone cry, I find, than to try to make someone laugh. It's very, very vulnerable to be like, this is what I find funny. Do you find it funny? So I decided to do these first person fragment sections, and I gave them to this character who is a woman, Eleanor, in the novel, who in terms of the role she plays in the book would be archetypally the other woman, which I'm putting in quotes. And I knew that if I was going to introduce a third person to the marriage in some way, that there was going to be, and especially if she was a woman, and especially if she was a slightly older woman, she's in her late 30s, you know, she's very different to Cleo, that there was going to be judgment towards her. And I really wanted to push both myself and the reader to identify and inhabit her. In a way that was kind of inescapable. And when you put someone in first person, like, you're right there with her. And I gave her everything I've ever found funny, I gave to this character, and so many observations from my own life as a copywriter I gave to her. And so it was like, it was a really like useful character because it was just like anything I'd ever noted got put in her perspective. And she's ended up, I would say, I think she's probably the most popular character of the novel. She's certainly the one that's, from what I'm hearing from readers, like captured the heart of most people, which I'm very happy about.
Yeah, because she is such a surprise. I think that's why I delighted in Eleanor so much. Like, I love it when books surprise me. And that turn in the narration, immediately I was like, oh my God, okay, I did not see this coming. I did not expect this, which is always a really exciting experience as a reader. And then to find that there is like this really incredible voice within that choice. Do you know what I mean? Like, I absolutely loved it.
Oh, I'm so happy to hear that. It makes me laugh because I think people often, everyone's like, so you're Cleo, right? And I'm like, I really do write fiction. And then I'm like, very few of my characters share that many lived experiences with me. But I'm like, I really think I'm mostly Eleanor. Like, in terms of just like pure biographical sort of insights, like so much of what I've thought or said to my friends or expressed is like, I just gave it directly to Eleanor. So it's really nice to see that she has been so embraced. It makes me very happy whenever I see it.
So this, I mean, I feel like maybe this question, the answer is in the length of time it took you to write the book, but I'm going to ask it anyway. It's set in 2007. Why did you choose to set it in the past? Why not present day?
I set it in the past for, yeah, it's a great question. And it's, I didn't sort of labor the point, you know, like there are a couple, if for anyone who lives in New York, like Barney's is still open, Dean and DeLuca is still around. So there's like a couple of sort of small things. The two main reasons is one, I really wasn't that interested in having social media be part of this narrative. I didn't think that it would. One, there are novelists who are really amazing on writing about the internet. I just don't think I'm one of them. And, you know, like TikTok didn't exist when I was writing the book. Like, it just would have dated itself so quickly to have had social media and that kind of technology as part of the narrative. So that was just like a practical side of it. And the second side is that I moved to New York when I was 15 as a teenager. I went to high school there and I moved in 2004, but I was like very active in nightlife in sort of 2007 when I was a teenager, around like 17, 18. And it was just a really sort of halcyon, gorgeous time in New York, in my memory, for sort of like artists and creatives being in the city, you know, before the crash, this kind of like peak moment of just like partying and excess and indulgence and fun that obviously is like just about to end and none of us knew, but I think on an sort of unconscious level that darkness that's sort of looming around the corner was very much there. So I always wanted to write about that period of New York history.
Nice. Okay, yeah, that's so unexpected, but it makes a lot of sense.
Agree. Yes. And on that
2007 forever.
We did want to talk about like the New York vibe of it because it is so strong. Like when we talked about it before off the record, we were talking about it in the context of something like one of my favorite books, which is What I Love by Siri Husvert, like these very kind of New York-y New York books. Please talk to us a little bit about writing this very kind of city life book. I loved hearing about the halcyon days. If there's anything else you would like to add on that note, I would love to hear it.
I mean, it's so funny. It's like, I moved to New York when I was 15 and I lived there until I was 30. So that's like, it's a very formative period of my own life. And I think moving as a teenager and not being from there, but, you know, kind of having this sort of funny relationship to the city and that I went to high school there. So it does feel like my home and where I did so much of my growing up. I just really, really fell in love with New York in such a deep way. Also as a teenager where you love so fully, you know, it really feels like I had a sort of romance with the city that, like a romance, was, you know, wonderful and ecstatic and joyful and also like heartbreaking and painful and hurtful. And I just really wanted to write about the city that I loved, you know. It felt like and I felt that I had been just so engaged with the city for so long in such a deep way that it was just such a rich source to pull from. And I wanted to write about a globalized aspect of New York, which is that it's a special city in that many people come who aren't from there and make it their home. And you end up with these kind of like ragtag groups of people who have very, very different backgrounds. And what they have in common is the city and the kind of characteristics of the city, which is that hunger and the ambition and sometimes the arrogance, you know, all of those things. And I felt that the group of sort of friends and family that I wrote about are very reflective of that. And that's reflective of my own experience in New York, to be honest.
There's also quite a lot of darkness in that depiction of not just New York, but of the group of people that the novel focuses on, like themes of loneliness and addiction. How was it? How did it feel like writing about these kind of darker aspects of city life?
For me, it felt inevitable and unavoidable, really. You know, I couldn't. This book has always been about the kind of glittering surface and then the darkness beneath that. And my own experience of living in the city, you know, in my 20s, I got sober when I was 26, which I've, you know, I'm very open about. But the years preceding that, you know, it was this kind of, you know, there was so much about that time in my life that I remember so fondly, and it was wonderful in so many ways, but it was also very destructive. And the people that I was drawn to being around were these kind of high flyers who had like a long way to fall. And I wanted to write about people who are very different once you get close to them than they appear on the surface. And I think as both a reader and a writer, that's a really exciting experience to think like, oh, I assume that I know what this person's like. You know, for example, the novel, the second chapter is a wedding scene. So we're seeing everyone, you know, in kind of like wedding best at the party, you know, in the social situation where everyone's kind of performing their identity. And then it's, for me, it was so fascinating and exciting to then go with one of the characters somewhere private where no one else can see them. And then what are they like then in that moment? And I hope for the reader, like, that's kind of a thrilling experience. And for me as a writer, I loved doing it. I'm always trying to like burrow closer to like intimacy and privacy and vulnerability. And the shinier the outside, for me, the more complex the inside. So
yeah, I think that's definitely something. The way that I described this book on TikTok was like, everyone has a secret in this book, but as the reader, you get to find out everything. So like, it's very satisfying. Yeah, a little like
you're very
back.
VIP as the reader of this book. There's not much you don't have access to.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, this is another thing I've also been very open about, which, like, my dad was like, don't tell people how much you got rejected. and my dad does work in advertising, so, which feels very true to form. And I felt that, one, it just never occurred. It's like, the story of how I got published is the story. There's nothing, I can't change it. And so I always would be honest about it. And for me, so I wrote the book from when I was 25, and I think I got an agent maybe like 4 years into working on it. So I worked on it in my MFA for 2 years, and then I went back to copywriting, and I would copywrite during the day as a fashion copywriter, and then I would write this book mostly in my evenings and on my weekends. And it was partly because of that that it took a long time to write, because that's just like slow going. And also just the complexity of the characters and the number of characters I was working with meant the book like kind of kept expanding beyond the scope that I had imagined for it. So felt like truly never ending at so many points in my life. And then I got an agent after many agents turning me down, and because they felt that it wasn't plotty enough, the book. And they loved the characters, they loved the writing, but they didn't feel it had a ton of forward momentum. And I worked agent on it for a year, and she was wonderful. And then we sent it out to 15 UK publishers and 15 US publishers. And then you just sort of sit and wait. And it is, you know, an excruciating period where you feel like, you know, your skin has just been taken off and you have to just walk around the world without like sort of any buffer. And one thing you do learn as a writer is the no's come first. So you always have to, not always, some writers never have to experience this, but lucky for you, but most, you have to wade through at least a few rejections to get to the yeses. So the no's started to come, and it was painful, but I, you know, I held out hope. And then eventually I got a Word document from my agent, and it was all 30 rejections, one after the other. And partly though, reading through that Word document I was crying because I read it, but partly from just like true joy, which sounds kind of silly, but because it was so thoughtful what people had written about the book, and the connection to the characters and the kind of love for what was working was so clear. And so many people had really taken the time to write long responses about what they loved, and they were so careful and respectful of the process of being a debut novelist. But ultimately, every single one of them felt that as its current form, something wasn't quite clicking. And luckily, there was one editor in the UK and one editor in the US who I will always be grateful to, because I now know how incredibly busy they are, how much editors have to read, who said they would read it again if I was willing to make some structural changes and kind of and get the plot like a much tighter. So I took a Christmas break and I worked on it over that Christmas, and I resubmitted it, and then both those editors ended up buying it, which is how I ended up coming out with Bloomsbury and Fourth Estate. So it was a happy ending in the end, but it was it took much longer than I thought it would. It was at times I never felt hopeless, to be honest. I always thought, okay, if it doesn't happen for this book, I'll write another book and maybe some of the chapters can work as short stories. You know, I always was thinking about like, okay, like how can I keep going? But there were definitely times where my hope wavered, let's say.
Oh man, it sounds like a roller coaster. And like, obviously it's really admirable that you were still imagining what else you could do with the book. But I feel so glad that you didn't have to. You didn't have to cannibalize it into short stories. Because, my God, it's such a good time.
It's also testament to the fact that, you know, I feel like a lot of authors would get those 30 rejections or 28 rejections and then, you know, read two editors saying, I'd be happy to look at it again if you reworked it, but then feel so disheartened by the rejections that they don't work on it and just move on to something else. So I guess it is just testament to the fact that like sometimes that feedback is very sincere, like they do actually want to see it succeed, you just have to do the work.
Yeah for sure.
Yeah, I think one of the benefits is like I did an MFA where it's all workshop, and I also after and before my MFA took like night writing classes.
Oh, wow. What
to call them. Basically these like writing workshops that meet at sort of like 8 p.m. till 11 p.m. And so by that point, I had been workshopping for years, you know, so I was very used to getting feedback on my work. And also in recovery, like, you know, in sobriety, so much of what I do is just like, you just kind of like, you just constantly talk about things and people like give you advice. That's sort of the whole life. So I got very, and you know, when you get sober, you have to kind of recognize that, like, I recognize that my way of doing things didn't always get me to the place I wanted to be. So it's a very humbling experience, and it's a wonderful experience because you end up being like, maybe I should listen to people who know more than me. So I felt like if all of these editors are kind of essentially saying the same thing, which is that the characters work and the language works, you know, and they were really, really enthusiastic and kind, but over and over again, they were saying like, the plot's not there. And like, readers do read for plot. I read for plot. You want to know what happens. At the draft of the book I had submitted, we would sometimes not see Cleo and Frank for like 80 pages.
Ooh.
Which like, if you've... Exactly. And like, yeah. If a reader has invested in Cleo and Frank, that is very frustrating. I was like, who cares? Fine. because I'd never written a book before, you know, so I didn't really understand that you have to kind of make good on the promises you make early in the novel. So... They were right. You know, I could see I was trying to do something a little bit more experimental that ultimately didn't serve the book and was not only experimental. It was that actually I didn't know how to do plot. That's the truth. Like, I knew how to make a beautiful scene. I really had no idea how to like link something over the course of a whole book. That just doesn't come that naturally to me as a writer. So that's what I had to really work on.
Do you think having now worked through that process, going into book two, do you feel like that's a skill that you now have honed, or do you think that you will still always write kind of vibe forward?
I think, vibe forward, love that. And I finished the hopefully second draft of my second book yesterday.
Oh my God, champagne time. Well, not champagne, but insensitive thing to say, apologize.
Oh my God, no worries at all. I definitely, going into my second book, I think I had like a little bit of kind of like, I had maybe some PTSD from the first book. So I was like, what's the plot? But to be honest, I'm just, you know, I was taught in school that there's situation and there's story. Situation is what's physically happening, what would be considered plot. And story is what's emotionally happening. And I am always interested in story. Like, I always start with emotion. That's just my way in. And so, you know, the example my teacher gave is like, one person's going to write, three people are trapped in an elevator, and that's the, you know, that's what they want to write about. And another person is going to say, I want to write about three people that have to confront something they've been avoiding. Maybe I'll put them in an elevator, you know? So
yeah, yeah.
I always start with, what is the emotion? So for the second book, I kind of tried to create a plot, and I went like overboard, and it was like, oh God, I hated it. I was like, oh, there's like a mystery element suddenly. Like, so I completely took it out, and I went back to like, what is the emotional arc for each of these characters? Like, where do they start and where do they need to go? Because the formula that I was taught for plot, which is time times character equals change. And that's plot. And that is really helpful for me.
Yeah, that differentiation as well between the emotional arc and what happens is really, like, interesting, like, definition. I'm going to carry that one with me.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I've never had, like, any formal writing education. And I feel like this is the wisdom I've been missing out on. Like, these are useful little nuggets of wisdom.
Yes, they are. They're really, like, some of these things have really, really helped me, to be honest. Because it's just, I mean, there are, and then you guys are probably examples of this. Some people, they just have this kind of natural gift with storytelling where, I mean, many people write and never do MFAs and never do workshops. But I was not one of them.
No, I was not one of them either. I'm repping. I'm a workshop queen.
Yeah, for sure. I have a writing group in LA. I am just writing group all the way. I really am.
Okay, so I just have like one more question to ask. We've kind of touched upon book two. I'm guessing, are you keeping that one close to your chest right now?
I mean, I've talked a little bit about it. I mean, it's in such like, it's hopefully mostly written, but I mean, of course, then there's the whole industry level stuff of agent responses and then, you know, editors reading it. So, but it's, at the moment, it's called Blue Sisters, and it's the story of, it opens on the 1 year anniversary of one of the sisters' deaths, and there's four of them to begin with. And then the story is told from the perspective of the remaining three. And they're very, very different. It's like one is a lawyer in London, one is a boxer in LA, and one is a model in Paris.
Ooh.
So they have these incredibly different lives that they each sort of self-destruct or implode in the wake of this, you know, really tragic loss of their fourth sister. And they all end up back in New York in the apartment that they grew up in. And it's sort of only by returning to each other that they begin to like heal this really sort of tremendous loss. But a little bit like back to the honeymoon thing of writing something, it's a story that is about grief and it's about loss, but it's also, I hope, quite like funny and kind of light and glam in another way.
Oh, okay. Sort of I'm ready for that. Like chic like, grief.
Exactly. It's like, I feel like whenever I describe it to people, they're like, oh yeah, sounds like a laugh a minute.
You know? Like, well, that's the thing. I think at first I was like, oh no, this sounds really sad. I'm into sad books. I'm ready. But then, okay, we're throwing something different in the mix. It's chic. There's going to be some fun shit going on as well.
I think Cleopatra and Frankenstein also, I hope, does this, where it's always flitting between the light and the dark tonally. You know, you never really have, you know, sad things are incredibly funny and funny things are incredibly sad, you know? So I'm always trying to work with both.
So I do actually have another question that I was decided that I wouldn't ask because I was worried it's too spoilery, but I'm going to, sorry, Bethany, I'm hogging now. I'm going to I'm going to try and phrase it in a way that's not a spoiler, but just bear in mind that people listening, not everyone will have read the book yet. So only one character of the characters that we spend significant time with, only one character doesn't end up in some form of a happier or better place at the end of the novel.
Mm-hmm.
How did you choose? Like, why did you choose not to give everyone, like, why did everyone not end up with like an uplifting story? If that question makes sense.
Yeah, it does. I'm going to try to think how to talk about it without spoiling. I had given that character, can I just say who the character is?
Yeah, it'll be fine. It's not a big spoiler.
Quentin. So I had given Quentin a different ending initially. I had sent him to rehab where he like bonded with a horse called Cressida, which really made me laugh. But I had decided later on that one, I felt that it felt too neat for every single character to have like a kind of a hopeful or storybook ending. So I went back and I thought about some of the characters, maybe that within the 2-year scope of the novel, would they necessarily be able to devolve and then evolve in that time frame? Own experience of action, I felt that 2 years was too quick a time
sure.
to both become addicted and also come out the other side. So what I felt was that for that character, by the end of the novel, they would still very much be in the center of the kind of the destruction. It was a hard one for me, and I also was very aware that, like, as the queer character in the book, I sometimes people tend to read this book in a moralizing way, which I really push back against. I really don't believe in reading characters through a moral. I don't think that's a massively rich lens to read character. I never ever wanted it to seem that some of my characters are punished for what they do and others are not. I wanted it to be realistic, which is that addiction is messy and progressive and sometimes takes a long time to heal from, and truly very few people ever do. So I felt that it was a realistic ending, although it was not the one that I initially chose, because I so am not inclined towards like conflict. Or I'm like, I'm always trying to get them out of situations with my characters, and it's not to the benefit of the novel. So we'll be like, let it be messy, you know, like let them behave badly if they need to, let them be angry, let them fight. And I'm like, no. But I got there eventually.
My Thank husband you always so makes much. Fun of me because I am whenever we're watching something that has like lots of characters and conflict and whatever. He goes, you like it when they're all friends. And I'm like, yeah, I like it when they're all friends. Like, that's literally how I want to, really, you know. And obviously that doesn't make for, like, good, dramatic, you know, storytelling. But for me, as a little baby in the world, I like it when they're all friends.
Yeah, I mean, I just want to say...
I like him.
I just want to say thank you for that insight, because I wasn't sure whether or not to ask the question. I didn't want to imply... that I like disapproved of that choice, but it did. It hurt me a little bit. It hurt me reading that arc, and you know, books should be painful. They should give you an emotional response. So yeah, I really appreciate hearing like the choices that went into and the thought that went into that plot line. Because God, it's so heartbreaking. But of course, you're right. When you think about the scope of the book, it's 2 years. Like, it's such a short amount of time, really. It's such like a brief, so much happens to these people, but it's actually such a brief window in their lives.
I actually found that quite like, I don't know, you know, if you read a book and you really like it the way that I really liked this book, you sort of like to think of the characters as like vaguely real people. And something that I quite liked about the compressed time span of the book was almost the knowledge that like, even if things are going badly for someone, or even if a relationship fails, like in the grand scheme of these people's lives, this is actually quite a brief moment.
Yeah.
I think that's very hopeful. I mean, the final line of the book, which obviously I won't say, but it literally is saying things carry on.
This
is the end of this novel. This is the end of this window of life for these characters. But what I hope is that at the end of the book, you can really kind of imagine and sort of intuit a much, you know, longer life and story for every single one of these characters, which is, you know, things that you may potentially seem happy at the end of the book. Who knows? We check back in with them in 10 years, like perhaps would have crumbled, you know, and other things. And characters who maybe are not in such a solid place at the end of the book could be doing really well. You know, that's truly the nature of life.
So before we depart and leave you to your leaf blowing escapades or whatever you do in LA, what books are
mostly
you?
Mostly that.
Yeah, mostly just leaf blowing and going in the swimming pool. What is on your radar in terms of like books you're excited about that are on the horizon, or something you've read recently that you were really into? Basically, shout out something that you are hyped about right now.
Ooh, well, the debut novel that I read recently in February, my husband read it. He picked it up in a bookstore because he loved the cover. It's called Beasts of a Little Land by Joo-hae Kim. And it's historical fiction, technically. And it's the story of a period in the 1940s in Korea, where Korea was fighting for independence from Japanese invasion. and it's told, it follows a group of sort of young women who are courtesans in Korea at the time, and it's about their relationships and their friendships and their romances, and then also there's a kind of political plot line. It is, I thought it was absolutely breathtaking, you know, sweeping in its scope, so romantic, incredibly informative about the history of just such a phenomenal country. And then I went to the Tucson Literary Festival 2 weekends ago, and I ended up speaking on a panel with the author, and I was so excited. And Juhe was like, is just the most, truly the most delightful person. So it was really cool to read her novel, having no idea that I would ever meet her. So huge shout out to her book, which, you know, I recommend it even more thoroughly, given the fact I now know that she's like a lovely person, but I truly would have recommended it even if she wasn't, because I think it's so good.
This sounds right up my street. I'm going to see
it. It really does.
Oh, it was honestly, I was just swept away by it. It was such a wonderful reading experience. And then the book I'm most excited about coming out, of course, to bring it back, is Jennifer Egan's The Candy House.
Oh my God.
April, cannot wait, I am so buzzing, anticipated.
April is in like no time at all.
I'm really curious.
April is so soon, and by the time this episode goes out, it will be April.
Yeah, it will be. Oh my God.
So curious. I have been thinking a lot, actually, because, you know, she's working with some of the same characters from Visit from the Goon Squad, and how she's sort of going to navigate that. And, you know, so much of what I hear from readers is like, I want a whole book of Eleanor, and I want this, and I want this. I want to know what happens to Santiago. And I don't know if I'll ever write a sequel to this. I truly don't know. But I'm very curious to see how another author has done it.
Yeah.
After having written other books.
And, like, a long time as well, right? Like, it's been, what, 15 years?
Yes.
Something
like
that.
It's very cool. It's very, very cool. I cannot wait. And I think I'm getting sent... I said in another podcast or something that was the book I was most excited about, or in an interview that was, like, a Q&A written out. And then her publisher contacted me and said, like, we'd love to send you an early copy. And I was, like, I was screaming. So I am checking the mail, like, every single day, because I have never been sent an early copy of anyone's book yet.
What?
This is a new part of my career.
Yeah, surely by now, at this stage.
No, I know. I was so excited for that point, but I'm like, and Jennifer Egan, what an author to start with. So
yeah, what the perfect book to kick off your new career as someone who receives proofs.
I know, I can't wait.
I'm so jealous.
Every day.
I'm happy for you. I'm jealous. I can't wait.
I think it's the thing is, I think it's out in like truly a week.
So yeah, it really is.
I think I'm on the sort of list of like the last list to receive. Obviously still extremely flattered. Even if you get it a day early, I'd be thrilled, but
oh my God. Okay, well, I can't wait. I can't wait to see what you think of it. And yeah, I think that's it. That's the end of the interview. We've smashed it.
I have had such a nice time talking to you. I hope you've had a nice time talking to us.
I did. I did.
So your book, Cleopatra and Frankenstein, is out now. So if you've listened to this episode and feel moved to read it, you literally can. It's there for you.
It's available in all good bookshops.
And bad ones. But just all bookshops. Well, thank you so much for your time, and enjoy your LA life.
See you next time. Bye.